Welcome to episode 113 of Redboard Rewind. My name is Spencer Loganbule, and today my special guest is an in-the-money favorite. He is also a book author along with PTF. It is Mike Maloney. So happy to have Mike on the show today as we go over three races from Kentucky Downs from their closing weekend on Saturday. Those races were 4, 8, and 9. And some angles that we talked about are why post positions are so important in horse racing, and an angle that Mike likes where you pair up buyer figures and usually there's a forward move with a lightly raced horse. This is Redboard Rewind. It's the same old story in this cycle. We go back and forth. We go back and forth. It ain't good for me what we do this for. We go back and forth. Won't do this no more. All we want, always ever sell it. 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 All we want. And now I'd like to welcome in my special guest, someone who I had way back in the day when I was first starting this podcast about 100 episodes ago. It is none other than Betting with an Edge writer, co-author, however you want to say it, Mike Maloney. Mike, how are you today?
Good, Spencer. Great to be with you.
Glad to have you on. How we're going to talk a little bit of Kentucky Downs today. How is your, I know it's a small meet, only 5 days. How's it been going so far for you?
You know, it ended up okay, Spencer, but, you know, you always wish it could be better, but that's a, you know, it's a unique, meet, a tough meet. So, I guess any win is a good win, but, there are things that if I could rewind back, I would definitely do a little differently.
I think also just for me, it's been such a hard time with the different track in general. You only have it for 5 days. There's not a lot of data you can really compute on it. Maybe now that it's been going for a couple more years, but the turf course is so difficult for me because it is like a European turf course. So of course everyone sees the Euros and you're like, well, was it this one or is it the other one that can work out well? Has there been anything with that where you kind of see, you know, specific tracks from overseas that kind of help you understand which horses will take to the track and whatnot?
Evaluating the horses from overseas is one of my weaknesses. Mm-hmm. And usually before the Breeders' Cup, let's say, I'll check in with the Grand Poobah PTF and get his thoughts from across the pond on the different horses and also, you know, the things he's heard from other people about those horses. So, you know, he's one of the connections I use for that because, you know, I think it's important to realize your strengths and weaknesses as a player, and evaluating overseas form is definitely one of my weaknesses.
I had a good friend of mine, Marshall Sterling, on the pod last week, and we were kind of getting into talking strengths and weaknesses as well, how he feels like he is a much better turf handicapper, and he actually had a really good Kentucky Downs meet. Do you feel like you're a better turf handicapper or dirt handicapper?
Definitely dirt. I'll have my moments on turf, but yeah, two-thirds of the races that baffle me after they're over, that I have a hard time really figuring out what I didn't see properly or what I miscalculated are turf races. So nearly all dirt races I can figure out after the fact kind of what happened. Turf races, there are some where I just end up scratching my head and turning the page.
I kind of feel like that way as well, because a lot of stuff with turf is also pace in general, and I'm not the strongest pace handicapper. And a lot of it's trip handicapping too, which is also not one of my strengths. And I feel like for me, in certain races, when I can find a lone speed on turf, you know, that's, you know, 8 or 9 to 1 that might get misrepresented on the tote board, that's where I kind of have an edge in turf racing. Also, just because I'm a more overall class handicapper, I think I understand the class hierarchy more. How the bottom level for dirt at some tracks is 8,000, 5,000, but the minimum it would be for turf is 15 to 20. It always had that little bit of a bump. And I think sometimes when horses go turf to dirt, people think, oh, it's a jump in class when they go from 5 to 15. But if it's the bottom level for the turf racing, it's the bottom's the bottom.
Well, that's true. And I do think class in general seems to mean more on the turf than it does on the dirt. And that could possibly be one of my issues with turf racing is that I pay some attention to class, but that's not one of my main points of emphasis. And I think that may lead to some of the weaknesses in the turf races sometimes.
For beginning handicappers that don't know, Kentucky Downs is an all turf meet. They only race 5 days out of the year, but they have gigantic purses and pools in general and large full fields. How much would you say your handle throughout the year is going through a meet like this, where we're getting a lot fuller fields compared to, you know, maybe a Keeneland or a Churchill Downs?
It's not much different, Spencer. I play Kentucky Downs, Keeneland, and Churchill Downs all heavily. So there's not a lot of difference in my play between those three tracks. They're all big tracks for me. Turfway Park, I used to be able to do the same there years ago. The last several years, I haven't been able to do that at Turfway for various reasons. It's the races are tough there. The horses, a lot of the horses have gotten cheaper and cheaper. And the surface varies a lot from night to night. I'm hoping that a lot of the negative factors at Turfway Park are in the process of changing. There's a new surface being put in there. There's going to be a significant investment made in Turfway Park, mainly on the gaming side. But hopefully that will pull up the racing there also. And overall in Kentucky, our racing is on the uptick, with the as well as Kentucky Downs is doing, and of course Keeneland and Churchill. If we can get Ellis and Turfway up to speed, and both I see improvement in both places there, we're going to have a very strong year round circuit here, hopefully very soon.
A question I didn't really prep you for, but one that I was thinking with on the way home from work was Betting with an Edge came out a couple of years ago. Is there something now in racing that you feel like maybe you could have added to the book, or maybe one thing that maybe isn't as important, even though it was only a couple of years ago?
I guess this sounds a little cocky maybe, but I'm really pleased with the way the book has played out. Several of the points that Pete and I made in the book are proving themselves out. So I've been really pleased with the points that we made in the books and the things that we emphasized, how the 3 or 4 years since then has really, made us look good, I think.
I don't think it's so much cocky. I mean, one of my favorite things in there, you just, when you have a single or you have a specific horse, and the kill shot's not the right word for it, but it's just, you want to go in double barreling, making sure you get a lot of your money in on the right spot. And I talk with so many newer players now that they see that a lot of them are so takeout oriented, which is good. But if you're brand new to the game, trying to hit a couple pick fives, it's very difficult when you're only supposed to hit on average 3 out of 100 or whatever it works out mathematically to. And I've been telling friends, if you're like a pick five sequence, you can still play it. But make sure if you have a single in there that's in the middle of the leg, play a pick three, play a double, play just a straight win bet. That way, at least your smaller multis or just your win play show bets can pay for that ticket. That way, you're kind of free rolling the ticket, and it could end up paying a couple thousand dollars.
Well, I think that's good advice. I think that's, if I could pick out one mistake that I think most players make when they're newer into the game, and I did the same thing when I started out in the game. It is you want to get ahead of yourself. Mm-hmm. You want to go 60 miles an hour when you should be going 40. And by that, I mean, just kind of what you said there, you instead of taking on racing's most difficult wagers, you should make sure that you have a positive ROI, or that you feel like you have a very good understanding of racing's simplest bets. You're not going to be successful in the pick five pool over a long period of time if you're not successful in the wind pool. And, you know, it makes sense from a standpoint of just if you can't pick winners, you can't pick one winner, you can't pick five. But beyond that, it's just knowing yourself, knowing your game, knowing what type horses and what type races that are your strongest, where you can have confidence in that single when you do try to move into a pick sequence. And I think your advice of pick threes, more pick threes and fewer pick fives is good advice, and especially at Kentucky Downs, because there's I don't know of a tougher track on the planet to try to run a pick five on short money than Kentucky Downs.
Well, I think that's also just, you know, you open up the form and it feels like Saratoga on a Saturday, except it's every day because there's 16 horses in every race. And just getting back to the bankroll in general and just the pick fives and pick fours, I believe it was Kerry Photius in one of the books I used to read who said, if you're not positive ROI in win betting, the fact that you're trying to play other bets is, everyone wants that one shot. They want that one shot that hits, you know, for a couple $1,000s, and they can bring it home to their friends or bring it home to the wife and say, hey, we can buy that new in-ground pool or whatever, et cetera. And from right now, I'm trying to also get into sports betting, knowing that sports betting is coming to New York soon. Hopefully it is already here, but to be able to do it from mobile and not just from the casinos. And I've been just listening up, and, you know, it's a lifelong game. You're not going to win at horse racing or just any game like this. Another one for me would be chess. Unless you take the time to study, you can't become a grandmaster in chess or expert, you know, 20%+ handicapper on the ROI side, unless if you kind of take your lumps and get beat up a little bit, or, you know, you're just so selective that you're only playing one race out of every 14 to 20 races. So you're playing one race every 2 days. That can get quite boring for a lot of people once you have those nerves of steel, I guess.
Yeah. And, you know, and that's one of the greatest things about racing, and especially about handicapping, is a relatively intelligent person can spend a lifetime trying to learn everything they can about handicapping and about betting, and you never conquer it. Mm-hmm. You know, it doesn't matter how good you get. The best people that I've ever met as gamblers and horse players, they still have their down times, as, you know, as I do. And it's humbling, but it's one of the things that makes it so fascinating and such a challenge to try to play the horses.
Have you noticed the caveat between whether you're on a really good hot streak or you're just on a little bit of a downswing, that you kind of feel like maybe it's I'm not spending as much time as I usually do with the race replays, or I'm just, you know, I'm looking at, you know, oh, Gaffleone's 36% the last 2 weeks. I'm just going to play a lot more Gaffleone. And not that you're taking shortcuts, but you're just not spending that extra, you know, half an hour or an hour that you usually do, whether it's time commitments with family or anything. Do you ever notice a correlation between a hot streak and when you're cooling off a little bit?
Yes, I do for sure. And that's one of the things that Pete and I spent a lot of time on in Betting with an Edge, and is knowing yourself, basically handicapping yourself, not just handicapping the horses. Mm-hmm. So as I write in the book, there are days when my daily limit will be 10% of what it is on other days. Well, that sounds a little crazy to some people, but it comes from my experience over the years of knowing that there are days when I'm much more likely to win than other days. And I have enough confidence in myself that I feel like I'm eligible to win any day that I participate. But my the truth of the numbers is that there are days and meets where I'm more likely to win than other meets and days.
I think so too, just overall. Not that I'm becoming so much more of a weekend warrior, but a couple of years ago I maybe scoffed at the fact that, you know, oh, it's a lot more fun to play on the weekends with the bigger pools and the better racing. I've always been more of a low-level claiming, you know, maiden race type person compared to the allowance and the stake race, just how I've always been. I feel like I have an edge there. And recently, just this year, from playing Saratoga and a couple other, you know, Churchill, I feel like maybe I'm starting to now swing a little bit the other way, and I feel like I have a better grasp on the stake racing, and I'm not spending as able to spend as much time on pedigree with the maidens, and it's definitely taking a downswing. So I'm kind of in that in-between mode now where I can't put maybe a full investment on a day of where, you know, it might be a couple, you know, $100, maybe only putting 50 through the pool. And it's when you know that and you're on a tailspin or a losing streak, that's how you save your bankroll throughout the year, and not so much in other ways. Obviously chasing, there's other examples, but I think that when you know you're not seeing the ball well, that's the time to maybe take a step back and just cut your bankroll a little bit.
That, I think that's great advice too. One of the things that I've been saying for years, and then I tell myself when I get in that situation is what, how you handle your worst losing streak is really what defines you as a horse player. And I think that's very true. And I think the longer people are in the game and the more serious that their play becomes, I think the more that they see that. There are lots of really good handicappers that I know, some of them better handicappers than myself, for sure, that I've watched crash and burn over the years. And it's not because they can't pick winners. It's not because they're not good handicappers. It's because they couldn't handle that downturn, or a series of downturns. That, you know, when you're playing the horses on a regular basis, and you've probably maybe experienced something like this yourself, you'll go through downtimes, and you'll go through streaks where it just doesn't seem to matter what you do, how hard you work, you know, how good your ideas seem to be before the race runs. It just doesn't seem to be in the cards for you. That's the nature of racing. And I think that's the nature of gambling as a whole. Luckily those streaks don't seem to come along very often, but I've experienced them myself. And, you know, I still have lots of rules in play on a daily basis that I use to try to protect myself from slipping back, you know, into one of those streaks.
Let's stop talking about these losing streaks. Let's try and help these people make some money, maybe not with Kentucky Downs, but maybe down the road. Let's start off with race number 4 from Saturday, Kentucky Downs. It was a maiden special weight, $135,000 is the purse, 1 mile. What did you like in this race, Mike?
I didn't have a lot of opinion here, but I'm a guy that will gravitate toward the vertical bets sometimes, and I chose to make a real small play in this race in the tries and supers, and I keyed number 4 Cool Rags in third and fourth. The play was very small because the horse hadn't been out in a couple of months, and I wasn't 100% sure about his fitness. But I thought there was a lot of speed in the race, and I thought the shape of the race was set up for a horse to come from off the pace, and he was a nice price. So that was my small play.
We kind of always talk about trying to find the winners in races. Instead, you've keyed on a horse here that you don't need to actually have win the race. Is that more, would you say, of an advanced technique? And for people, it should be just mostly trying to find the contenders in the race and the winner, more or less than trying to find, you know, oh, I think this 85, the one shot's being underplayed in the trifecta, and I should try and play him there. Obviously, you should try to, you know, find where they think they'll place the best. But win, place, show, I know a lot of people don't like place and show money. I'm someone that kind of is on the other side of the fence where I think win, place, show, based on certain odds and how you've done overall, should tell you how to make the play.
I don't know if I would call it an advanced play. I just think it's an underused play. I think it's a play that most people aren't familiar with and aren't comfortable with. But I think it's something that if you maybe play it a little on paper, and when you see a horse that just looks like, as we all see every day, we see races with a lot of speed, and we see horses that don't look good enough to win and probably don't look good enough to run second, but they look like they'll be finishing and passing tired speed horses at the end of the race. So That's the basic philosophy behind this bet. I did not use Cool Rags to first or second at all. I liked him to pick up a piece and come late, so only used him third and fourth. But there's nothing really super advanced about setting a bet up this way. It's just, I think that it's a little unusual.
For me, the number six, Group Hug, I did have a note off that last race at Saratoga. Gold, rail, dirt, and turf. And this one was obviously closing a little bit from the outside, so I kind of wanted to get this one involved a little bit. I thought the number eight, Cleat, coming off that first race, that solid 64 buyer on a very, very fast pace on the, based off time form, thought this one was one that had to be used. And Mount Kenya, the morning line favorite, Rafael Bejarano, Vicky Oliver, couple races, nice improvement. But definitely nice improvement first time turf and closing into a slow pace. The old JK special, still can't get away from it that well. The one horse I was not interested at all ended up going off as second choice was Caveat Emperor. When I see horses like this, Mike, that just have that slow improvement on the buyer, maybe 1 or 2 points each time, I'm just not expecting a bigger jump than 1 or 2 points. And I feel like when I have other horses that I can see jumping 5 to 10 points, even though it is turf racing and their jumps are usually smaller, this is just one I didn't want. I thought when I saw how much money it was taking, I was very confused. And I was like, well, either I'm right or the public's right.
Yeah. And I didn't think it was any exceptional value at 2 to 1, but he did have a pattern that's favorable to me in that he was kind of pairing or even tripling up around the same number. And when a young horse, a lightly raced horse, this horse is 4 years old, but he's lightly racing in great hands. And sometimes a horse like that will move forward.
And that's just where I think it just becomes different handicapping styles for you. That
right.
is more of a positive. And I've heard Matt Bernier and I've heard a couple other people, and maybe I'm now on the wrong side of it where I do need to start looking at it. Obviously 2 to 1, the odds are not in our favor that well. And maybe for me, I should start looking at it more with those 8 and 9 to 1 shots. I think in the meantime, this is just one I did want to avoid. For me in this race, I was using Cleat and Group Hug. For Mike, he was using the number 3, Cool Rags and Trifectas. Let's see who gets it done on the 4th at Kentucky Downs right now.
Old Licorice missed the break by just a bit. Cleat is going out to the front. Van Dusen on the inside out. Well, Mackay is away running in third. Vancouver Moon is fourth. Caveat Emptor is fifth on the outside. Invisible War is sixth and racing near the rail. After that comes Time for a Woodford, who's in between horses. Unembellished is there on the outside. Then it's Group Hug, Bold Licorice. Last of them all is Cool Rags. So they have 3/4 of a mile to run. And Cleat, who came out of the gate quickly, leads the way by 3/4 of a length. Van Dusen to the inside is running in second. And just to the outside comes Mackay. And these two are stride for stride, and they're 4 lengths off of Cleat, who's getting away. After that comes Caveat Emptor, who's about 7 lengths behind, but moving up now. 3 clear of Unembellished, racing on the outside of Time for a Woodford, while Vancouver Moon is down toward the rail with a 1/2 mile to run. Group Hug is after that, and then Invisible War, Bold Licorice to the outside, and still at the back is Cool Rags. Make their way around the turn, still in pursuit of Cleat and James Graham, trying to take them all the way after a 46.3 half mile. Cleat turning for home in front. Mackay on the outside is second. Caveat Emptor getting involved now in third, and these three arrive at the quarter pole together. Right behind them is Van Dusen in fourth. 3/16 of a mile to run. Caveat Emptor and Cleat. Caveat Emptor has the lead. Cleat on the inside is second. And they're followed by Mackay in third as they come down to the final 16th. It is Caveat Emptor. Caveat Emptor is going to win in hand under Arad Ortiz, easily by 5 lengths under the wire. Bold Licorice missed the break by just a bit. Cleat is going out to the front. Van Dusen on the inside out. Well, Mackay is away running in third. Vancouver Moon is fourth. Caveat Emptor is fifth on the outside. Invisible War is sixth and racing near the rail. After that comes Time for a Woodford, who's in between horses. Unembellished is there on the outside. Then it's Group Hug, Bold Licorice. Last of them all is Cool Rags. So they have 3/4 of a mile to run. And Cleat, who came out of the gate quickly, leads the way by 3/4 of a length. Van Dusen to the inside is running in second, and just to the outside comes Mackay, and these two are stride for stride, and they're 4 lengths off of Cleat, who's getting away. After that comes Caveat Emptor, who's about seven lengths behind but moving up now. Three clear of Unembellished racing on the outside of Time for a Woodford, while Vancouver Mood is down toward the rail with a half mile to run. Group Hug is after that, and then Invisible War, Bold Licorice to the outside, and still at the back is Cool Rags. They make their way around the turn, still in pursuit of Cleet and James Graham, trying to take them all the way after a 46.3 half mile. Cleet turning for home in front. Mackay on the outside is second. Caveat Emptor getting involved now in third, and these three arrive at the quarter pole together. Right behind them is Van Dusen in fourth. 3/16 of a mile to run. Caveat Emptor and Cleet. Caveat Emptor has the lead. Cleet on the inside is second. And they're followed by Mackay in third as they come down to the final 16th. It is Caveat Emptor. Caveat Emptor is going to win in hand under Arad Ortiz easily by five lengths under the wire.
And Caveat Emperor, the number nine, gets it done. 680 the winning mutual, 89 the winning buyer. I was very wrong. You were very right. This horse did take a little bit of a jump up. Cool Rags runs fourth, which has just got to be pretty gross beat, especially going off at 29-1. And I mean, when closers are doing that, it just kind of ends up being, are they going to get there or not?
Yeah, it wasn't good in the try. It did catch me a little super. And I felt lucky to get that. I mean, he got up by a head and was lucky to weave his way through and get there for that. So, it worked out okay. Made a few bucks in there. You know, back to Caveat Emptor, he wasn't a horse that I was in love with. I'm not taking any credit on the red board for picking him. He was just a contender for me. And you know, like I said, no particular value at 2-1.
I think though too, and we're not saying that you had picked him, but just the fact that you had said that sometimes these horses can take a jump forward, this one did. I think it's just a good angle for people to kind of have back in their toolbox again. Some other horses in the race. I mean, Group Hug came back and ran a 78. The one thing that I am interested about with Cool Rags is the 61 before the layoff. Maybe that's the reason for the layoff. They thought this one was tailing off. Comes right back and runs a 72, which is pretty much what this horse was running around its better races in the prior before the layoff. Do you kind of feel like that happens a lot where they tail off in their first time back? They kind of come back running that same type of buyer sometimes when they're in pretty good hands in the training department?
Yeah, I think that's true. But, one reason that I like Cool Rags was I thought the last time he ran, he got steadied at the gate pretty badly and lost all position and then ran wide. So the last race didn't bother me. It was kind of a throwout race for me. I went back to the couple of races before that, and he looked like, if he ran those races, like you say, that he could be part of the try, the super. So that's the way I approached it.
I kind of got beat up here with Cleet running so well, 7-1, ends up running a faraway second. When you see horses like this that run those really quick fractions first time out a lot, I think a lot of people think, oh, they're just going to become those burnout types that just go to the lead and just never can really, hold on. This one ran another nice second here. Do you kind of see this one where they can finally hone in that speed and just kind of maybe find the winner's circle with maybe a different track? Obviously, Kentucky Downs is such a weirdly shaped track. And then, maybe a small drop in class.
Yeah, horses like Cleet are always hard for me to evaluate, Spencer. When they've had one lifetime start, and then they come back and either change tracks or change surfaces or change distances for that second start, it's always a tough call for me. So those are the type horses that I rarely build a bet around. They're horses that you have to include a lot of times, as I did here, just to protect yourself. But mm-hmm. Those are not my most reliable horses as a rule.
Let's move on to race number 8 from Kentucky Downs this past Saturday. It was the grade through FanDuel Turf Sprint, 6 furlongs on the turf. We have Got Stormy coming back. We have one of my favorites in Gear Jockey. What'd you like in here, Mike?
I went for Imprimis out of the 12 hole, and that post position really bothered me. It was a big concern for me. But I liked the horse, and I thought that there was a chance. He has a little tactical speed, and I thought there was a chance that he might find a decent spot at some point, especially, with a rider with a rider like that, you he had IRAD up, and you know, I have a lot of confidence in him working out a good trip a lot of times, but the price was the main factor there. At 7-1, I thought he was as good as anything in the race, and he seemed like value to me.
I can't agree with you more there. I feel like what is so hard for people when they first start out playing is how important certain post positions are in certain races. And I feel like the 12 hole at Kentucky Downs, or just the 12 hole in a lot of places, if horses don't have tactical speed, unlike this one. And sometimes the post position just makes you the second or third best horse, even if you put forth a really good effort.
Well, that's true. I am generally a guy that possibly overemphasizes post position. So it was that stung a little bit with him, but I think I have a personal relationship with Imperfumus too. Mm-hmm. I know Joe Arsino a little bit, and he's a heck of a nice guy and a great trainer. That may have had a small influence on my decision, but Imperfumus, very good horse, and the trip was totally the question. The price was right, but the trip was definitely a question.
Let's kind of talk about Got Stormy here. I'm the type of guy that every time Got Stormy wins, I'm usually off. Every time I think she's going to win, she loses. What is your kind of relationship with this horse? And I mean, she's been racing for so long. She's such a good mare at this point. I just, the last time in the 4-star Dave, I thought she had no shot, and bang, there she goes and wins.
My relationship is exactly like you. I kind of thought in May and June of this year, I kind of thought she was on the way out. Mm-hmm. It just seemed like her form had deteriorated some. And then at Saratoga, she just totally reversed, ran a really nice race and a 104 buyer, and she's back in business. So that makes it hard to evaluate her for me coming into this race. I played around her and didn't use her in this race.
She ended up being my top pick for ABR over there. I do a nice little thing for them, going over a couple of stake races with a couple of amazing handicappers like Mike Somich, John Piasek, etc. The one I placed second, the one that I actually played in the race, was number 4 gear jockey Jose Lescano for Rusty Arnold. I just feel like with this horse, bet him in the Troy, bet him in that allowance win, I just feel like I have a good handle. And sometimes you just get that. You get a good relationship with a horse that you just like, he's really in good form. I think he's going to run well today. And there's other horses that you're just like, oh, see that last race, it was a little bit of a decline in the buyer. Like, to a lot of people, it wouldn't seem like a big deal. But to you, you just like, that's the raindrop before the storm, and this one's going to tail off form real quickly.
Yeah. I know exactly what you're saying. And gear jockey was, had taken that bad trip, got out terribly in his last start, finished up really nicely. He made a lot of sense in this race. And if I hadn't got caught up in my Imperfumus love affair, he could have been the horse I landed on.
For me, it's number 4, gear jockey. For Mike, it's Imperfumus. Let's see if gear jockey can get it done again, or if the post position works out for Mike in this grade 3 right now.
In the FanDuel Turf Sprint, Bombard is sent out of there with early speed. Diamond Oops on the inside. Fast Boat is close up as well. And then it's Gear Jockey away running in fourth as they race down the hill and make their way to the 5-furlong pole here. Front running Bombard leads the way with 5 furlongs to go. Gear Jockey on the outside, up running in second. Diamond Oops is third. Born Great is fourth. Fast Boat fifth on the inside. And then Imperfumus in sixth. Got Stormy in the middle of the pack. Stubbins is narrow on the outside. And then a ground-saving trip for Front Run the Fed. CM Reap is in behind them as they make their way around the far turn. And then it's Chewing Gum who's on the far outside. Casa Creed is down at the rail. Bombard runs a 22.38 opening quarter mile. And he makes his way to the top of the stretch in front. Bombard turning for home on the lead. Gear Jockey on the outside second, and they're into the stretch. These two are 1-2. There's still a quarter of a mile to run. Imprimis is sent along and behind them and is now up running in third. Fast Boat, Diamond Oops right there. Stubbins got Stormy trying to come through an opening in between horses. It is Gear Jockey. Gear Jockey, the one to catch, arriving at the 16th pole and in the clear from Bombard. Gear Jockey is going to do it in the $1 million FanDuel Turf Sprint.
And the number four, Gear Jockey, gets it done, paying $13.40 with a little bit of a price drop there out of the gate, or right before the gate pop. Diamond Oops running second. Bombard was third. The winning buyer was $105 for Gear Jockey. Just keeps on improving every single race.
Yes, he does. He's turning into a really nice turf sprinter. Rusty Arnold seems to have a knack for doing this, taking these horses and getting them to really improve race after race, even after they've had a few starts. I'm drawing a blank on the name of the turf sprinter that he kind of did that with last year. But
oh, I know who you're talking about. I can't think of the name either.
Yeah, I should have prepared that a little better. But, you see him do it multiple times, and it's not just with turf sprinters. But he seems to have a particular knack for that. So it was totally foreseeable that Gear Jockey could step his game up.
Imprimis didn't do too well in the race, finished bottom half. But we have horses like Casa Creed, Fast Boat, and Got Stormy who are, right off of the tote board there, fourth, fifth, and sixth. Do you kind of feel like it's just a race where maybe they just didn't handle the Kentucky Downs surface? Or, is it just now Got Stormy is kind of that in-and-out type and, Casa Creed and Fast Boat just weren't good enough?
I'd say that's yet to be determined. I don't have a strong opinion on either one of them, but God Stormy and Imprimis both had good winning races over the Kentucky Downs surface mm-hmm. previously, so it's hard to say it's a surface. They both got hung outside, and I thought Saturday at Kentucky Downs, I thought the first 4 days were pretty much, I didn't think there was any bias. Saturday, I thought, it was very, very minute, but I thought that horses that were previously some horses were winning just laying four wide all the way around the track. You didn't see that on Saturday. And I think, just a slight change in the nature of the track. The last 2 days they shifted down to the permanent rail.
Mm-hmm.
So the other four cards were run on different settings. And it makes sense that the track may have changed a little the last 2 days. But I'm not saying, the Imprimis, obviously, he didn't run his race. But from my style of handicapping, Got Stormy and Imprimis, I can't eliminate those horses when they run back because they could have had an excuse. I can't unload on them either because I'm not sure about the excuse, but that's the nature of racing sometime and the nature of horse playing. The approach that I will take is to watch the first horse that runs back that had a wide trip in this race and just evaluate, did they dramatically improve? And if they did, then I'll follow that route for the other run back.
What are your thoughts on the number one, Diamond Oops? 8 for 21 lifetime. This one just ran another bang-up second here at 21-1. So it's not like this one doesn't like to win. And obviously, 5 for 14 on fast dirt, 2 for 2 on a wet, and 1 for 5 on turf, but 3 in the board finishes. I feel like this one just likes every single type of surface and just, I think, got a little bit forgotten about in this race.
Yeah, he definitely was an overlay in the race. I have a hard time with Diamond Oops. I don't really understand exactly what makes him run and what doesn't. And Patrick Biancone horses in general, sometimes I struggle with. So they definitely ran a good race in this race. And if the inside was slightly helping, he would have been the benefactor of that. Mm-hmm. The superfect in this race was the inside four horses and paid $4,000 for a dollar, something mm-hmm. like that.
Let's move on to race number 9 from Kentucky Downs. It's the Calumet Turf Cup. It is a grade 2, mile and a half on the turf course. I always struggle with these marathon distance races, unless if I'm betting a horse named Lone Rock, who seems to be the one that just wins all of these type of races now. But in past years, I've just had such a struggle. What did you end up liking in here, Mike?
You know, this was the race I was most interested in all day. I really liked number 9, Glenn County. And not from a standpoint that, oh, this horse has to win, he can't lose. But from the standpoint that I had confidence in Glenn County showing up and running his race and being a part of the exact or the try. And also that I knew there would be some value there. I was slightly surprised. He ended up going off at 6-1. I thought he might be, you know, more in the 8-10-1 range. He was 15-1 on the morning line. But he was a horse I really, really had confidence in. And it's always hard to narrow races down at Kentucky Downs. And I'm always careful, hesitant about trying to narrow races down too far or having too much confidence in, you know, it has to be these three horses or something like that. Sometimes it works, but that's dangerous business at Kentucky Downs. But the rest of the race, I was interested in the 1, Imperador, the 3, Channel Cat, and the 5, Arclo. And I used a few other horses on the bottom of the tries and the supers, but those were what I thought were the main players in the race.
I was just so afraid with Arclo being the favorite. Hadn't run really that triple-digit buyer in the last couple, and I'm not saying at 7 that he was over the hill, but I just didn't know if we were going to see that. He is 3-for-3 in the exacta so far at Kentucky Downs. I just didn't know if we were going to see the same Arclo come back, so I was trying to avoid a horse like Emperador on the rail for Paul Lobo. Nice race last time out, but did have a bit of a slow pace and wasn't exactly on the pace, but I just didn't know what to expect now going to Kentucky Downs for the first time. This one is 7-for-13 lifetime in the exacta. I ended up on your horse, number 9, Glenn County, 15-1. I couldn't believe the price when I looked at it. I feel like my brain is still stuck on how good Mike Maker was in the beginning of Saratoga, and I can't like transfix that he's like 2 for his last 85 or whatever he was since he took that dry spell at Saratoga. And I just, the last two races, another JK special, slow-paced race, closing into. I love Tyler when it comes to Kentucky racing. I just think he's one of the better ones out there for the time being. I mean, Maker at 1-for-24 is definitely scary, but the fact that this horse also took money, I think should just explain to everyone that the morning line was probably a bit off on this one.
Yeah, I would agree with that. You know, hence both of us, you know, liking him at that price, but it probably was a little high. You mentioned Arclo there, and I kind of felt the same way you did. You know, he has the ability. You know, he likes the distance and the surface. But even though he had excuses in those last couple of races, when a horse gets to be 7, I always have that little voice in the back of my head saying, you know, have they lost a step? So I know exactly what you were saying there. And looking back after the race, red boarding as we're doing here, Arclo, I probably should have given him a little more emphasis in my ticket structure than I actually did.
It's a consensus pick of top picks for me and Mike going after Glenn County. Mike's also using horses like Arclo and Emperador and tries. Let's see who can get it done here in this grade 2 right now.
In the Calumet Turf Cup. Emperador on the inside, out well. And now moving up on the outside of horses, Epic Bromance and Breakpoint. Up and after the lead, and Epic Bromance will take charge early. And now Big Dreaming moves up a spot into the second position. Channel Cat settles back, runs in third. Tide of the Sea is fourth. And then comes Artemis Eagle, fifth on the outside as they make their way toward this first turn. They're being followed by Crossfire Hurricane, who's 6 lengths off the lead. Arclo in behind them, then Imperador down toward the rail. A 4-wide Breakpoint is next. It's a big gap back to the trailer, Dyna Drive. So they pass this first turn and head toward the backstretch here in pursuit of Epic Romance, who went 23.75, a very fast fraction for this mile and a half distance. There's 1 mile to go. Big Dreaming is running along in second. Channel Cat is third on the inside. Tide of the Sea tracks them in fourth. Crossfire Hurricane, fifth in between horses. And then comes Glynn County on the outside, followed by Arklow and Imperador, who's down toward the rail. Break of another 2 lengths more, and they're being followed by Breakpoint. And at the back of the pack, A Journey to Freedom and Dyna Drive. So they went this first half mile in 48.6 seconds. They passed the 6-furlong pole, and they come downhill and head for the 5-furlong marker here. And it is wide open up front here. On the inside, Channel Cat comes on through to challenge for the lead. It is Channel Cat on the inside. Big Dreaming right alongside in second. Epic Romance still up with the leaders in third with a half mile to go. And then it's Glynn County racing along in fourth in between horses, along with Tide of the Sea. Those two are right together. And on their inside comes Crossfire Hurricane. Three quarters up in 113.15 seconds. And they're coming toward the top of the stretch here. 3 furlongs to run. Epic Romance on the outside has a slight lead as they come to the top of the stretch. Right alongside is Channel Cat in second. Arklow trying to fight his way in between horses. He's in traffic there, and he had to steady behind a wall of horses. Imperador is moving on the outside. Right up there, too, is Glynn County, who's coming with a rush. Imperador and Glynn County, these two emerge 1-2. Arklow trying to come back after steadying early, but he's running out of time. Imperador's got it. Imperador from Arklow, who's making a final bid. Imperador!
And the number one, Imperador, gets it done. 100 is the buyer. 1920, the winning mutual. Just a really well-run race. Nice to see Joe Talamo in the winner's circle, as always. Had kind of a rough start to the meet. Nice picks here, Mike. Nice little trifecta. I don't know if you had it on the ticket, but all three we talked about, all three in the trifecta.
Yeah, I did have a good try. You know, it's when you hit one, it's never good enough. Mm-hmm. And I used Channel Cat in my other horses also, in my contenders. Mm-hmm. So I didn't exactly have it cold, but it was a very good result. It looked like Glynn County got a good enough trip that it looked like Gaffleon might get all the money with him early in the stretch, but he hung a little bit, kind of, you know, could be the maker being a little cool, could be that he just kind of exposed himself as exactly what he is. He ran a good race, but he also got a pretty good setup in there, so I doubt that he will be my play of the day again anytime soon, but he did what we needed him to do this day.
I think so, too, when you look at Arklow, his race two back, Imperador is right there in the United Nations running second. And sometimes just horses that, when they're in the same type of class or in the same type of races together, and then they show up, you know, one or two races later, and then they run really well against each other, it kind of tells you what the kind of class those type of animals have.
Yeah, I think that's true. You know, another thing in this race, too, is Arklow had kind of a nightmare trip in the mm-hmm. stretch. He was very likely best in this race. Just was totally loaded as they turned for home. Never really found anywhere to go, and it got worse in midstretch when he actually did have to take up a little and change course and finished really, really well from that point on. So I probably got a little more in that try than I should have, because Arklow probably should have got the money.
Now that we're done with Kentucky Downs, we move on to Churchill. Is there anything specific that you look for angle wise or, you know, maybe connection wise that some connections to obviously Mike Maker for one didn't do too well. He'll obviously probably be split more in New York and also in Kentucky, I would imagine. Is there anything you're looking for now this first week coming back into Churchill?
You know, it used to be that I really focused on certain trainers, and Dale Romans was a guy that for years I particularly watched when Churchill started. But as these trainers ship more around the country, and get a lot of them get bigger stables than they had in the past. You know, things, I think things change over time. So my approach now is that the results on the track will tell me who's hot and who's not. And the first couple of cards at Churchill or at any major track, or any track I'm playing seriously, major or minor, I'm really focused. I'm going to spend a lot of time, even after the races, going back and looking at who outran their odds and who underperformed. Trainers and riders and the circuits that those horses shipped in from. So I don't think there's a better use of your time if you're going to play a meet seriously than really grinding over the first day or two results and then carry that on, you know, through the first week. But you'll find almost every meet, you'll find an immediate pattern of trainers that are doing well and trainers that aren't, and jockeys the same way. For instance, at Saratoga, you know, it was, you know, how quickly was it evident that Luis Saez and Mike Baker were hot? I mean, it was evident from Jump Street. And that happens a lot of times at a lot of meets. So Kentucky Downs, unfortunately, you know, it's not long enough to get a good beat on it. I still try to use it there. Rosario obviously stamped himself immediately this meet. But that, you know, there's probably no better advice than I can give out than that simple advice of just identifying the hot players and then, you know, use your handicapping, use your other techniques and your other skills, but give that a little extra credence to try to include those hot players. And when you find, which it sounds unlikely, but in reality, it's not that unlikely, on the third day of the meet or the fourth day of the meet, when you find a connection that you're already sure that they're hot and you like the horse and you're getting what you think is a fair price, you know, that's time to increase your bet a little bit or skip a couple other races and funnel it into that race, because you really have a lot of factors coming together in your favor.
I think so too. And I've talked about on this show before, I keep a clipboard right next to me when I'm watching the races. And if a horse wins the race and pays more than $10, I mark the connections down. If they can do it twice in the same week, I look at that as the barn is heating up or someone is, you know, heating up. Jose Ortiz, I think in the first 4 weeks of that 8-week meet at Saratoga, had 3+ $10 winners every week. And then he substantially cooled off. So I was hitting him very well in the beginning of the meet. And then I kind of week 5 and 6 had to realize he was cooling off, and it took me a couple races, but that's something I do. And for someone who I, you know, normally didn't look at as a top jock, Dylan Davis, had so many 10-to-1 shots hit the board at the Saratoga meet. And the way I do it is the same thing with the clipboard. Can they hit it instead of having 2 wins? Can they hit 4 times in the money with a 10-to-1 shot or better to show that, you know, obviously those type of riders aren't getting the top horses in every race, but are they making the correct moves that can get a horse maybe third when he should more likely be fifth? Well, if he starts getting on horses that are better than the rest, he's going to start winning races. And I think that that's just something like we had just talked about, you know, making sure you're looking at connections, who's heating up and who is cooling down.
I love the last part of that, Spencer. I think you nailed it. You can find riders and trainers who aren't necessarily winning, but like you say, they're running second or third with that 10-to-1 shot or occasionally winning. And you'll see horses that run third or fourth beating 2 or 3 lengths at 30-to-1 that, you know, they're touting themselves too, especially if you're a person that likes to play, you know, trifectas, superfectas, things like that. A rider that, you know, it's kind of what we're all looking for. Mm-hmm. We're looking for the edge before all our competition has the edge. And one of the best ways to do that is to just be super, super aware of the trainers and the riders that are, even if they aren't winning, they're overperforming.
Speaking of Betting with an Edge, don't forget to go try and pick up Betting with an Edge. I'm sure PTF might even have some books left. I'm sure it's on Amazon. Guys, go read this book. It's fantastic. Literally, life matters with Mike, and he explains from beginning to end what he's done as a professional handicapper, has some really, really good angles and stuff in there that I use every single day for me as a handicapper. And with that, that's the end of the pod. I want to thank my special guest, Mike Maloney, for coming on. Mike, where can people find you on social media to kind of talk horses and ask you some stuff about Kentucky racing?
I'm not a big participant in social media, but I am on Twitter at Silk, S-I-L-K, 1900. Also, one quick note about the book. I love people reading the book and get lots of good comments about it, but unfortunately, it is hard to find, and I apologize for that to everyone out there. Our publisher, the DRF Press, went out of business after they published the first round. So PTF and I have conversations about trying to self-publish or something, but we haven't done that at this point. Maybe we will at some point. But once again, Pete may have a couple of copies. I'm not sure, but it is hard to find, and I do apologize for that.
That's all right with me, Mike. If people really want to read it, maybe I'll give them my copy. We'll have to see how that is. Thank you so much for coming on the show. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Spencer.
To thank all the wonderful listeners for listening to this program and my special guest, Mike Maloney. This show has been a production of In the Money Media. In the Money Media's president is Pierre Thomas Forentail. Our chief creative officer is Jonathan Kinchin. And our In the Money Media business manager is Drew Coatney. I'm Spencer Luganbuehl, and we will see you next time.